Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
See the USA in your Chevrolet. America is asking you to call. Drive your Chevrolet through the USA. America's the greatest land of all. On a highway or a road along a levee. Performance is sweeter. Nothing can beat her. Life is completer in a Chevy. So make a date today to see the USA. See it in your Chevrolet.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. And the excitement of getting your driver's license, cruising down the highway with the top down and the radio volume up. Americans have long had a love affair with cars, Chevrolets, and many others. And according to AAA, the typical driver spends about an hour a day in the car. But the idea of actually loving your car may be a relic of the past. Cars today are expensive. Car insurance is expensive. The advanced safety systems, plus cars being full of new exclusive technology, makes cars expensive to repair. Joining us now is Dan Neal, auto columnist for the Wall Street Journal, who recently wrote about what's ending America's love affair with cars. Welcome to All Sides, Dan.
Hello, Amy. Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming in on the show. So let's start with the obvious question. Has America's love affair with the car actually ended?
The car is kind of a mass market and a common luxury of transportation, ease, mobility. Yeah, that has largely come to an end. It's basically too expensive for most working people to keep pouring money into their car just to get to work. So it becomes a very a terrible catch-22.
Now, you cite in your article that you wrote for the Wall Street Journal that America's love affair with cars has ended basically because of the expense. But prices for everything are increasing. We still buy houses, even though those are ridiculously expensive. So why should higher costs end America's love affair with the car?
Well, it is, as most people know, the second largest purchase that they make. And because it is, it's the numbers, the zeros are there where they aren't if you were to economize on whatever else you have to economize on. And there's also something, as I say, there's something deeply troubling about having to feed the machine that gets you to work just so you could pay to feed the machine to get you to work. It's an insidious circle. In the 50s and 60s, I mean, this was historically unusual times anyway, but this was the standard of living. And of course, we built an infrastructure and an economy around a mobile workforce, able to get to and from in and out of cities. When that breaks down, you know, it has knock-on effects that I think we're just only beginning to grapple with.
According to your article, 4 out of 5 American households depend on a car for work, school, and more. So talk more about how cars have become more of a necessity when they used to be a long time ago a luxury.
Well, they became a necessity by very much by design. General Motors famously took up the tracks in cities like Los Angeles when there was a footprint of mass transportations, and not just Los Angeles, in other cities. There was an unholy alliance between the gasoline companies and the car makers, and also the recreation. You played that Dinah Shore song, you know, see the USA in your Chevrolet. That was all part of a long-term campaign to convince Americans to get out on the road, to use gas, to enjoy the automobile lifestyle. And sure enough, after World War II and the hyper-prosperity of those years, the automobile became a fixture in most middle-class homes, as I say, by necessity. But when that very necessary thing becomes too expensive, it's It's not like you can, quit smoking cigarettes and save $40 a month. It's you still have to pay for it. So my as I think about the story more and more, I realized, the classist implications of it are tremendous. The reason the car industry is dwindling is because we're no longer serving the mass market audience. It's balkanized into smaller segments and smaller customer bases who all want sort of these specialty vehicles, and they spend more, driving up the cost of cars generally.
The auto industry has undergone major changes in recent years, too. This includes the increasing popularity of electric vehicles or people who have SUVs. There's different consumer behavior. There's a growing number of self-driving cars. Of all those things that I just listed, what's been the biggest change in the auto industry in the past few years?
Stock buybacks.
Oh, well, that's not what I thought you were going to say. Okay, explain.
No, the biggest problem is that these are legacy industries with huge, a lot of mouths to feed, and because of the financialization of the way these companies are leveraged in the market against the market, so the stock market becomes the most important thing. Shareholders, dividends on a quarterly basis, most important thing. And that has prevented these highly financialized OEMs in the West. I'm talking about BMW, Mercedes, GM, Ford, blah, blah, blah. Has prevented them from investing in a timely way to a new technology. And so the where that other where the other shoe falls is when they start to roll up and collapse, which is what we're seeing now. They didn't invest in new technology, and they can't find the profit in the old technology. So they're in a tough spot.
When it comes time to buy another car, are most people in the U.S. buying a new car or do they get used cars?
The used car market, used car market is quite a bit bigger than the new car market. That ratio has changed, and that's partly due to the average cost of new cars, somewhere around 48,000, and used cars are somewhere around 38,000 for the average. And then it's what I'm interested in is the replacement rate. Fewer and fewer people are buying cars, and more are embracing a car-free, let's say, standard of living, which is fine by me. From an environmental standpoint, the best car is no car. And this transition among younger buyers is a long predicted, and our obsession with the automobile is a part of our lifestyle is an artifact of the hyper prosperity of the 50s and 60s. And younger people are generally ready to move on.
Are younger people taking more public transportation, walking more, or are they using other people's cars by taking Lyfts and Ubers when they need to get somewhere?
Well, okay, so you've answered your own question for the most part. Shared mobility was a huge deal with younger people because it allowed them to offload the cost of maintaining a car, especially in the city, parking, all that stuff. So shared mobility, micro mobility. This is a thing that is a phenomenon that's much more pronounced in Europe, but in the US, you also have the rise of scooter fleets, bike fleets, other kinds of micro mobility, and you'll see more of that, I trust. And but again, doing without a car is harder because really it's not like I said in my story, we're going to tell somebody to take one of America's many lovely trains. We
What
just
trains? Yes.
exactly we have not spent the money on infrastructure to support a car-free workforce in any degree. I mean, we're talking about just the margins, right? If we could move 2% of the workforce off automobiles every year, that would be a big improvement, and it would reduce pressures in places like New York and Los Angeles and other global cities.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what's ending America's love affair with cars with Dan Neal, auto columnist for the Wall Street Journal. In doing research before I was talking to you today, I had almost forgotten about the government bailout of General Motors. It just feels like something that happened a long time ago. How are the big three automakers doing financially?
Not well, not great. And it's a multi-axial problem for a couple of them. General Motors, for example, one big problem was the loss of China. They had a joint venture, SAIC. They still do to some extent, but the GM brands and GM brand sales in China really dropped off. So that was always considered to be a hedge. No matter what they could do in North America, they could always make money in China. Well, no, that in the fullness of time, that turned out not to be the case. And Ford also has huge problems, but probably I think in terms of the top line for all of these companies, biggest problem is that they have spent a lot of money to build up electric vehicle manufacturing, battery supplies, to even accounting for the Biden administration's the IRA that required certain levels of domestic materials and production. Well, the automakers have been working toward those goals, and now the economic incentive for a lot of that work and investment has been taken away. When the Trump administration killed the EV tax credit, they also have gone after renewable energy credits and tried to claw back a lot of money from solar manufacturers. All this a very, how to say, a distinctly anti-EV agenda. And the car makers were going to have a tough enough time with disruption if it all went smoothly, never mind having to, take three steps forward and two back. I think it's going to be very expensive, the burn on the having to reorganize under the new rules are going to be tough. Now, there is one thing, though, as a what I think considers a miscarriage of public policy, the Trump administration is reduced penalties for missing your EPA fuel economy, the CAFE standards, to zero. So I'm not sure who that helps. And I doubt seriously those automakers will be taking that off the bottom line of the products they sell. So it's a little bit, there's quite a bit of detachment between the street and the boardroom.
Do consumers, whereas most consumers in America may have once bought from the big three American automakers, has that transferred to foreign automakers? Are Americans buying more Hondas and Kias than ever before?
Well, the numbers are a little bit deceptive because the best-selling kind of car and vehicle and light vehicle in the U.S. is a pickup truck, Ford F-150. Ram, the GMC Sierra, and but the pickup truck business is protected by the chicken tariff. Before the Trump tariffs in 1962, I think it was, the United States imposed what was called the chicken tax as a 20%, 25% import tariff on all trucks built overseas. Well, that has been the thing that has sheltered the domestic automakers. And been responsible for much of their growth and robust profits over the years because they didn't have any foreign competition really to worry about.
Why is it called chicken?
Why would it be
I
called
don't
chicken? It had something to do with chickens. Oh,
Okay.
I know because France, I think it was, had refused to buy American chickens. That's right. And it was a tit for tat that's still on the books. Oh my God. So many years later, it's crazy.
Okay. I had no idea chickens had anything to do with Ford trucks, but there you go.
It was a big break for the big three.
I got it. So, between technology and the increase of plastic parts, you also write in your story that repairing a car has become more and more impossible and more expensive. Can you talk more about this idea where if you put all this money, you spend $48,000 on a new car, and then 5 years from now you can't repair it?
Right. It is a consequence of it's a consequence of using more plastics in and underneath the hood of a car where the daily heat cycling will degrade any kind of plastic. No matter what, it's only a matter of time. And automakers were very eager to use plastic because it cut weight, it was cheaper, and so they did it. And they have used it in places that make it very uneconomical to repair in engines. And so now there's a great little game of who's to blame here. You know, if you talk to the automakers, they would say, well, we were just responding to the standards for higher mileage, lower emissions, and recyclability. We were trying to be green, and so it's not our fault that our engine, that these parts need to be replaced. But behind even that, there's this expectation. In the old days, people had the expectation you could have a car run for 200,000 miles if with proper maintenance. Doing that now is real hard for a lot of reasons. First, you had better be good at your own maintenance because there's about 100,000 jobs in the auto industry, their service industry, that's gone have gone unfilled. So, and the other thing is that it's just not economical. So people's expectations should be. I tell buyers, look, if you're going to buy a car, it's going to last 100, 150, 125,000 miles before you need to sell it because it won't be economical to fix it. And therefore, they are disposable. And they are, generally speaking, do you know that one in four cars looked at by crash specialists are totaled in the US, which is pretty close to disposable. On its own.
Well, let's talk more about that idea of them being disposable and even after a small fender bender being hard to repair in just a moment. We're talking with Wall Street Journal auto columnist Dan Neal. He's staying with us, and we're going to talk more about America's love affair with the car. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Chevrolet, baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, Chevrolet. They go together in the good old USA. Baseball, hot dogs, apple pie,
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And America's love affair with the car began in the early part of the 20th century. After World War II, the rubber really hit the road as Americans moved to the suburbs, and the U.S. interstate highway system was championed by President Eisenhower. Cars used to be as American as apple pie, but our attitudes toward cars went into overdrive as they became a necessity to get around, and cars became the gateway to travel, a way to see more of the United States. We're in the driver's seat this hour talking about how the high cost of cars now is ending America's love affair with the car. Still with us is Wall Street Journal auto columnist Dan Neal. Thanks again for being here, Dan.
Oh, thank you, Amy.
I wanted to get back to talking about that idea of cars being hard to repair. And because in your story, you wrote about a Tesla Cybertruck that was basically in a small like fender bender. It was struck in the left rear by a small sedan. And just from this little thing in the bumper, the Tesla had to be totaled. That seems like such a waste. Can you tell me more about that?
First, I agree. It's a waste. Somebody's little sedan got hurt. No, but seriously, the Cybertruck is a very unusual piece of engineering in a lot of ways. And while it had, it answered many demands, repairability wasn't one of them. And one of the signature technologies in Tesla cars. And this is not just Tesla anymore. Most modern manufacturers are using these die-cast aluminum structural pieces that are very large. In the Tesla, they call them giga castings. Anyway, they're large, complex, lightweight aluminum castings that take the place of some dozens or even hundreds of small pieces welded together. So they're lighter, they're more dimensionally exact, they have a lot of nice properties. But if they get cracked, it's the devil to repair them. And so that the Cybertruck is that's one example of a technology that's hard to get at and fix. In a larger sense, almost every modern car is incredibly hard to repair after an accident. And for the one example that I think is most insane is like headlights. Up until the early 70s, the United States, all cars had DOT approved round headlights, which were had the virtue of they weren't bright, but at least they were cheap. But these days, you have these compound headlamp assemblies with turn and running lights and indicators and LEDs and projector beams and so forth. These things can run a fortune. I had a friend of mine whose Bentley was almost totaled because some guy in a bike hit it while it was parked. And it's like a big car. Bike comes along and it's totaled. It's crazy. One pair of headlights I investigated were $18,000 a piece. Oh, that reminds me, before I let you, someone in this whole process said to me, it's one thing to go out and buy a cheap and expensive car that's marked down real cheap, but when you go to repair it, it's still an expensive car.
And not to mention all of the new safety systems that have been added. I mean, we have seat belts, we have 5 mile per hour bumpers and airbags. Those are all safety innovations that developed over time. But now cars have these advanced driver assist systems. So, they're going to signal when you go out of a lane. They might even brake for you if you're not braking fast enough.
Absolutely.
And so this is a part of the thing that you write in your story, that there is no such thing as a minor fender bender anymore if your car has this system. Is that because they're impossible for any mechanic to repair?
They're not impossible to repair, but they don't repair them, they replace them. And replacing them is very, very expensive. And really, in retrospect, it's a very interesting question of public policy. How many bumper fender benders has this technology prevented, as compared to, which is kind of an unknowable number, right? It'd be really hard to find that figure out with confidence, but as opposed to how much it costs to fix them when they are in accidents. These technologies, parking assistance, let's just take parking assistance. Why did parking assistance become so necessary? Because cars kept getting bigger and bigger, and car makers recognized their safety liability. And in fact, there are many cases of people getting run over by bigger and bigger cars because they couldn't see. So that led to this effort to create a safety net around the car. But in the long run, maybe it wasn't a good idea to put them right on the bumper where they're going to get hit all the time. Yes, that was kind of, this is definitely an unforced error among the in the industry.
There was a time when you could work on your own car in your driveway, but cars are so complex now that a lot of repairs need to be done at the dealership. You mentioned this earlier, there's a shortage of mechanics and auto technicians, but even if we had more mechanics and auto technicians, would they know how to fix a newer car?
Well, there's again, this is a, so this, every story has a long tail. So remember the plastics? Part of the plastic deals was that they knew in the early 2000s they were facing an incipient labor shortage. And what they strive to do, this is the design engineers, to compartmentalize, to make things replaceable, plug and play modules, or a plug and play components, so you didn't have to repair so much as just swap out these easy to get to modules, which were typically plastic. Well, that was a good idea in principle, but it was taken too far. And so now, if you take open the hood of any new vehicle, whether it has an electric motor or a gas engine, You'll see a lot of plastic panels that are not welcoming you to repair or to service. The automakers, this is the other thing, and this is the truth. The only thing that keeps dealers alive anymore is service. And so scheduled maintenance, dealer authorized service. That's where you come in for an oil change, they sell you a set of brakes. But that's where the money is for them. They don't make any money on new car sales. And so when you start to make things easier to repair for people at home, then they don't come into the dealership. And this is one of the big threats with Tesla. Tesla introduced what's called over-the-air updates, OTAs. This way, people could get their cars fixed, in fact, improved, without ever going to the dealership, which was definitely one of their least favorite things to do. And it was one of the ways that Tesla was able to steal a march on traditional franchising.
There's also the idea of to keep your car's warranty, if you get the warranty, then you have to do the service at the dealership. Some of them say that as well. So are they trying to put the old mom and pop mechanic out of business here?
Well, the right to repair is an amazing issue all itself, and it's in every state in the union, and it has gotten really, really ugly. The car makers spend millions a year in Washington to lobby against, well, to lobby in every 50-state capital against right to repair, expanding right to repair. Now it's kind of it's a standoff of sorts because the automakers need more technicians, more service. So they need to allow independent garages more access to tools, diagnostic software, blah blah blah. And but they don't like it, and they'd rather keep all of that in-house if they can. But it's but I think we've reached a point now where really we need to be more realistic. You're renting these cars for 5 or 6 years. They're like a phone that is going to get bricked when the new edition goes out. The idea of keeping these vehicles on the road for 150, 100, 200,000 miles, that is a romantic notion that comes to us from the past. It speaks to us emotionally because we hate to throw things away. But as a practical matter, this is the way the industry is heading. And if you're counting every gram of carbon, at least in the early stages, this recycling is. It'll get better and it'll eventually reach a closed loop status. But right now, it may not be as energy efficient as driving them for 200,000 miles overall.
I bought a new car last year. Well, it new to me, used car, but
Awful stuff.
you're making me wish I would have leased it though now instead.
Oh, yeah. You should have called last year. I was here. You could have called. But
Is
what was your
that
deal? Let me turn the tables on you. What'd you buy and how much did you pay for it?
a 2023 Subaru Ascent? So I bought a 23 in 24,
Right.
and it was 40,000 ish. I can't remember exactly right now because life, right? But that was for a used car. But it only had 7,000 miles on it. So I just anyway, but it was a lot.
Scads of room
Yeah,
on
lot. It was a lot cheaper than the 2025. I mean, it saved me almost
that.
$10,000. So
Yeah, preach.
anyway, but is leasing going to become more popular then? Do you feel like if people, because then if the car starts to annoy you can give it back?
I think leasing will be become more popular, and it's a dollars and cents kind of thing. It's the less out of pocket, I think, in the long run if you don't over your mileage. However, people are very excited about what are called extended warranties. Well,
I have one of those. Okay.
okay, so here's the issue with extended warranties. Not to, they don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but the issue is that these companies that sell extended warranties look for almost any reason to deny the claim. And they will fly spec every mile that's in the data recorder. When did you change the oil? So they look for any reason to get out of the covering extended warranty. If there was still such a thing as a consumer protection the agency,
Consumer Protection Bureau,
that thank you, that's the one. I would definitely have them look into these extended warranties because they promise a lot, but man, I hear it's hard to get them to pay.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what's ended America's love affair with cars with Dan Neal, auto columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Talk to me about 16-year-olds, because getting a driver's license right at 16 used to be a rite of passage. However, according to the Department of Transportation, the number of 16-year-olds with driver's licenses is decreasing. So why do you think younger generations are not as enthusiastic about driving as their parents and grandparents?
Well, there's a demographic sort of the a background here, and that is the increasing urbanization of U.S. populations. Now, 90% or so of Americans live in what you would call MMSAs and big metropolitan areas, and so there's that. There's also the cost, the economics of it, because it's the more expensive than ever. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I can tell you, it is breaking my back to keep her in a car. In the old days, you'd say, oh, we'll give you the car, and you just have to pay for the insurance. This is a common formulation for kids at home. But insurance is, she could never make enough to cover the insurance now, because that, too, has gone up. So in many ways, the disenchantment among young people emerges out of these expectations that they need a car, they should have a car. The culture tells them that, you know, it's more fun with a car, but they can't afford it. I think that that's probably, yes. Also, cars aren't as cool as they used to be. Let's just face it. The motorsports culture that I grew up in, which was immersive, to say the least, is gone for the most part. I mean, in the old days, drag racers were national heroes. In the old days, people knew who Craig Breedlove was, who knew Mario Andretti was. The younger people do have their motorsports heroes, your Travis Pastrana's and your stunt drivers and so forth, but it's a much smaller pie than it used to be. And I think it's contracting in interest because of all these other externalities.
Yeah, I insurance must be a lot more. I don't have a 16-year-old, so I haven't priced it out, but my first car was a 1986 Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra that I got from my grandfather, and my parents gave it to me and wanted me to get my license as soon as I turned 16, basically because they wanted me to drive my brother and sister around, right? So,
please tell me it was tan or gold. Was it tan or gold?
It was red. It was red, but it was it had faded so much. We all called it, we named it, you know, and we named it Rosie, but the paint had faded, so it was more of a brown than a red, yes.
Well, if you had the gold one, you could have had, that's the car in Fargo. Remember
yes,
the,
yes, I know.
Tan gold Sierra.
Tan Sierra.
That's
yes.
It. That's the line, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, yes. I'm very familiar with that line because of my car, but that first car that I had, you know, that I drove my brother and sister around in to save my parents time, it went up to, I think we got 230,000 miles on it. I drove that thing into the ground. It was amazing.
Wow, you really did.
Yeah. So, I mean, it died an epic death on a highway. But that doesn't happen anymore. Is that what you're saying? The cars don't make it that far?
It happens, and it's also uneven geographically, regionally. You know, cars are still a huge thing in Southern California. In fact, as always, Southern California is the birthplace of some very cool car culture, which is vital and more like folk art than anything else. And we've seen some of these trends like lowriders, which were once considered to be, you know, these breaches of automotive etiquette, are now celebrated as the folk artworks that they are. And I think young people, when it comes to stuff like that, they're way hip to that. They can appreciate those past trophies.
Yeah, I mean, when that car died in 1986, Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra, I cried. But maybe when my kids their first car dies, they're not going to cry because they're not going to care.
Well, I stole my mother's Dodge Dart when I was 8 years old and drove it until it was out of gas. Actually, that was the one of two cars I stole as a child. So I felt like I had destiny to be a car critic.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We've been speaking with Dan Neal, auto columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and he recently wrote about what is ending America's love affair with the car. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Amy. Cheers.
And coming up, we're going to talk about whether it's vintage autos or muscle cars from the 60s and 70s. We're going to talk about Americans' love affair with classic cars and if we still are keeping track of those classic cars. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
See Torino 1969 in the performance corner at your Ford dealers. The place you gotta go to see what's going on.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We've been talking about how the high costs are ending America's love affair with cars. But there are still car enthusiasts out there. You'll see them admiring Corvettes, Camaros, and Mustangs, maybe even a Ford Torino, and many more that are on display at car shows. They spend countless hours restoring, modifying, and detailing classic cars. From vintage autos to the muscle cars of the 60s and 70s, is the love affair of Americans with cars continuing? Helping to keep that love alive, joining us now is Tim Mulcahy, manager of Cleveland Power and Performance. Since 1986, they've been providing late model performance vehicle parts and automotive rebuilds. Welcome to All Sides, Tim.
Hey, good morning, Amy. How are you doing today?
Thanks for joining us. You know, earlier in the show, we talked about how high costs and the high cost to repair is ending America's love affair with cars. But I imagine you still see a lot of people who are in love with their cars. Do you agree? Do you see people who still love their cars?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that the love affair has shifted a little bit. It's not over. It's shifted and it's progressed. It's evolved, you know, along with the vehicles that we're driving. It is definitely not gone.
Okay, so tell me about that shift in the love affair. So are people loving their classic cars, but maybe they're not in love with their 2003, you know, random Honda?
So it's interesting that you bring the 2003 random Honda up, because those kind of vehicles are now coming back into popularity. But what I'm talking about is the new vehicles with all the nannies and controls on them and the monitoring devices. People are not in love with those. It feels more like a piece of technology. It's not a piece of an extension of your personality as much as it is a means to an end. And customization becomes more difficult the more the computer systems evolve. So therefore, people are going back to even stuff like a 2003. The resurgence in the early Chevy model pickup trucks has grown immensely with all the over elaborate systems being put into new trucks, which is driving the price up to $70,000, $80,000 for an entry-level pickup truck. Now, more people are going to buy some, oh, I'm going to go buy a 20-year-old Chevy for a fraction of that, and I'm going to know how to work on it, and I'm going to be allowed to work on it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Dan Neal with the Wall Street Journal, who we talked to earlier in the hour, he equated cars today as more like buying a laptop rather than buying how people used to love their cars. Because, you know, you have a laptop, you keep it for 5 years until it can't work anymore, then you get a new one. Do you see that? Is that how new cars are now?
Yeah, he hit the nail on the head with that one, because he does mention, like, what are they going to do? They're going to warranty it for 150,000 miles and then brick it? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it might sound conspiratorial, but it could potentially be true, you know. So yeah, people are coming to grips with that. I mean, what we do is a lot of custom vehicle stuff, whatever. It's modern vehicles, mostly classic vehicles. We do a lot of restorations, and we have, you know, guys with the, money to throw around come in, and I ask them about new vehicles. I'll say, why would you build this old truck instead of go purchase one? And a lot of them have similar thoughts as Dan did in this article with it is a laptop. How long is it going to last? If I get something from the 70s or 80s or 90s, at least I know I'm going to be able to work on it and nobody else is controlling it other than myself.
When I think of classic cars, I think more of cars from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But now, are cars from the 80s and 90s, are those classics?
Yeah, absolutely. You still have your staples of car culture like 69 Charger. Everybody loves that from Dukes of Hazzard. You have your, 69 Camaro. People love those cars. So those are kind of cars that are never going away. They're increasing in value, and there's people that are, beating down our door, so to speak, to spend money on restoring those cars. And it is, it's an industry-wide thing. I talk to a lot of guys who say, I want you to work on my car. And I say, well, I can't, we can't really get to it toward whatever it may be, next fall, next spring. And they say, I can't find a shop to work on it. So there are people that are willing to spend money on these classic cars, but what is a desirable car, what is a classic car, has certainly shifted. Because the guys who were looking at the cars coming out in the 90s, now they're older. Now they have enough money to spend on a classic car. So your late 90s Camaros and Transams are those cars now. They're becoming classic cars.
So maybe not like my powder blue 1994 Ford Escort. People aren't going to want to rebuild that.
No, that is becoming a car that people are trying to get their hands on with low mileage.
Really? Yeah.
100%. Yep, absolutely.
I wish I still had it then.
Yeah.
Okay, so based on your experience, what cars are the most popular for restoration? What do you see most people coming in with then?
Well, we sell a lot of Dodge stuff, so we're kind of, I wouldn't say pigeonholed into the Mopar market, but we're known for working on Mopars. So it's the 68 to 70 Chargers is what I think is the most requested, the most sought after, is kind of the holy grail in our industry as far as restoration, is that 68, 69, and 70 Charger.
Are they using them just for car shows, or are some people driving them around every day?
There's some people that are making them into daily drivers. More often than not, at least the ones that I see are just trailer queens and car show cars. Occasionally, somebody will want to have something done where it'll be a drag car, but it's typically trailer queen stuff, car show stuff, stuff that's really not getting driven a ton.
Are they an investment? If you keep one in 20 years from now, are they going to be worth more money or more money than you put into it?
That is the million-dollar question, because if we knew the answer to that, then obviously we would all jump on board and that we would skew that outcome. I think that there is a fine line between it becoming an investment and then it becoming a financial burden, because more often than not, you can go buy a car for, custom car at auction somewhere for less than you can have one built for. So it's like an endless, we could talk about this all day. It becomes tough to decipher when it's an investment, versus a money pit. But it just goes to show you, every day I'm talking to people on the phone that want to build a car from the 60s, the 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, the love affair has not gone anywhere. It is, again, just shifted a bit.
Okay, so whenever we talk about the Wall Street Journal article about the love America's love affair with car being a relic of the past, it literally is. So it's they don't love the cars of 2022, 2023, but they love these old cars. Is that what you think?
Well, I mean, you got to consider this. When I'm driving around with my 6-year-old son and he says Cybertruck, he goes nuts when he sees a Cybertruck. That's a brand new vehicle.
That's
So
true.
I don't know what he's going to think in 15 years, when he's able to maybe get into a vehicle of his own, so yeah, the kids get excited for some new vehicles too. So it's a evolution. I don't think it's a breakup with cars. I think it's just an evolution.
Yeah. Well, and we learned in the previous segment that Cybertrucks are impossible to repair if they're in even
Yeah.
like a minor fender bender. So there might not be Cybertrucks around for your son to for your son to buy if you can't
Well,
repair them.
unfortunately, I see this firsthand. We are very much in a throwaway culture. That's the way that vehicles have progressed. Dan mentions that in his article. You bring it up with the Cybertruck. A lot of these vehicles aren't made to be rebuilt if they've been in a collision. Half of the business here is restoring these cars. The other half is parting them out. So we buy wrecked cars from auction all the time, and we repurpose the parts. So we see it doesn't take a lot to total a vehicle, especially an EV.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about America's enduring love affair with classic cars with Tim Mulcahy, manager of Cleveland Power and Performance. What is a car you have in your shop right now that you're currently working on?
Oh, we got a handful of them. We have this one's a pretty unique one. It's a 1997 Trans Am that's getting turned into a road course vehicle. So it's getting a modern Corvette engine put in it, you know, all custom built suspension, fully wired. So it's a 90. It's again, what's kind of what we talked about before, what's becoming desirable. It's a 97 Trans Am that this person is putting quite a bit of money into to make it perform like a new Corvette, as opposed to just going to buy a new Corvette because it has sentimental value to them.
And you post on your website some of the cars that you've worked on. Your website has a 1954 Studebaker. That's a very pretty car.
Yeah.
Did it run well?
That was a cool car. That was one that a good customer of ours bought from an auction. That was somebody built that car and took it to SEMA years ago. And it was a show car. It was not a driver. We had to get that thing tweaked to make it, you know, the guy, our customer that bought it from auction wanted to drive it. So we had to make some changes to the vehicle to make it roadworthy. So it looked beautiful when we got it, but it just couldn't be driven. So there's the kind of another peek into the world of like, where is it a piece? Is this a piece of art or is it a car? So yeah, that was a really cool project. We made it functional. It was a beautiful piece of art. We turned it more into a street machine.
That's what I was going to ask. Did he want to drive it on the road or did he want to just be able to drive it to a car show?
No, it's Sunday driving.
Yeah.
These guys just want to do their Sunday driving type of thing.
Now, you mentioned art, cars being a piece of art. You also do custom bumpers. You had a picture on your website of a custom bumper of a Corvette that you turned into wall art. Is this for people who love cars so much they want to hang them on the wall?
It's for those guys, precisely for that. They have all that automobilia hanging up. I'm sure you've seen it. The old, you know, porcelain signs and the gas, you know, the old Sinclair gas signs and stuff like that. Those are the kind of guys who, you know, they'll commission us to make a vehicle automotive art. We call it automotive art for them. They'll call and say, hey, do you have a Charger, Challenger, Camaro, Corvette? Can we make a rear end wall art out of it? So for those guys, precisely.
Do you have a favorite car?
Yes, I have a favorite car. And I do get asked this a lot, and it's always interesting to discuss that with people, but pretty much any Chevy station wagon from 1960 to 1980, a blue Chevy station wagon in that huge range. So talking about like what's a desirable car, to me is a Caprice station wagon. That's like my dream car.
Is that one of the ones that had seats in the back that face the other way?
Yes. Correct.
You see those cars in movies now. Do you have one that's running?
No, I do not. Oh. I just have my mode of transportation. Here's the thing. When you see cars getting worked on every day I've been doing this for 18 years, the last thing I want to do is go work on my car. So I have a truck that is capable of doing the things I need to do with pulling stuff. I do enjoy cars, but again, it's, you know, I could live vicariously through some of these projects. I get to test drive them, you know, all these cars.
Do you work on newer cars or are you exclusively just working on older ones?
No, we work on newer cars. We do a lot of, like, if somebody in the area has a Viper or something that's like a domestic / exotic car like that, you know, we will work on them. Yeah, for sure.
Are you finding newer cars, are they harder to work on where they're mostly run by computers and you can't can you figure out what's wrong with them?
Yeah, well, you have all these devices pointing you in the right direction, whereas the old cars, you're doing a lot of stuff with the test light and with the multimeter and whatnot. So there's a lot of benefits to working on newer cars. You can look up a procedure on the computer and it'll tell you exactly how many hours it's supposed to take to change this part in a, you know, a newer Corvette. Well, you can't do that on some of these old cars.
How do you feel about car dealerships turning into service stations? Do you feel that they are trying to put places like you out of business because you have to take your car to the dealer to keep your warranty, stuff like that?
I mean, it only makes sense. It's good business practice. They should be doing that. If they're not doing that, you're not taking advantage of a huge customer base We'll be fine. We don't compete with dealerships. The guys that are bringing our stuff here, they already voided their warranty. They don't want to take it to a dealership.
Are you finding in recent years that no matter what kind of car you're repairing, it does cost more, not just for the labor, but actually the parts and just the amount of time it takes have costs gone up for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Just like anybody else. Just like, yeah, and in pretty much every industry, some stuff is kind of stayed consistent, but for the most part across the board, I mean, I don't have any metrics in front of me, but I wouldn't be surprised to see, a 25% increase from in the last couple of years, probably steadily. And just the cost of parts, material, shipping. And supply chain stuff does affect. We luckily haven't been affected recently by supply chain stuff, but it was a big problem a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, if it costs you more to get parts, if you ha like how you source them and where you have to get them from, is that harder and it costs more?
No, it's everything's easy to find with the internet. It's just you're at the mercy of, if you're in a vintage restoration or some kind of niche market like us, you're at the mercy of the vendor. If you it's not everything is an air quotes off the shelf part. Even though they might have it on a shelf, it's at a specialty shop, so they can kind of charge what they want. And we got to pay what they're charging, and the customer ultimately has to come to terms with, yeah, this is the name of the game when it comes to vehicle restoration or high performance cars.
We've been speaking with Tim Mulcahy, manager of Cleveland Power and Performance. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Amy. Can I ask you, what's your dream car?
Oh, my. I have my dream car right now. I'm driving a 20 a 2023 Subaru Ascent, and I love it because
Nice. Nice.
I wanted the third row to drive all the kids around, So,
Beautiful.
I'm pretty happy.
I like that. That's a simple answer. It's a good answer. It's very cool.
I'm a practical lady. So,
Yeah, not
you've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurovich.